CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Are you hiring but not sure where to find the best candidates? As a business owner, I can tell you that your company is only as good as the people you hire. I can also tell you that posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. But when you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with the dozens of different job sites. Until now. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, I can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and have the highest possible chance of finding that perfect candidate. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 300,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter and get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
Today on Face the Nation, ISIS on the move and another American city on edge.
No justice, no peace.
Cleveland authorities are on high alert after a white policeman is found not guilty in the shooting deaths of two African Americans. We'll have the latest, and as ISIS terrorists continue their rampage through Iraq and Syria, we'll ask the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, and the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, what can be done to stop them. Plus, on this Memorial Day weekend, a look back at Vietnam and what's changed in the 40 years since the fall of Saigon. It's all ahead because this is Face the Nation. Good morning. We are beginning this morning in Cleveland with the fallout overnight from the case of Cleveland officer Michael Brillo, who was acquitted yesterday of voluntary manslaughter in the shooting deaths of Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell. That was 2.5 years ago. CBS News correspondent Sharika Duncan is in Cleveland. Good morning, Sharika.
Good morning, Bob. The judge ruled yesterday that the use of force by Officer Brillo was justified under the circumstances. Now, right after that verdict was read, Brillo was obviously overcome with emotion. He was clearly relieved. He hugged his attorney and cried. Now, outside the courthouse in downtown Cleveland, there was outrage from the victim's family and some here in the community. For the most part, though, Saturday's protests remained peaceful. However, police say 71 people were arrested, mainly at night. Now, this case goes back to November of 2012. As you mentioned, Russell led police on a 22-mile chase. Police mistook the car's backfire for gunshots and shot at the car 137 times. Yesterday, Judge John P. O'Donnell described the bullet wounds and explained why he could not conclude Brillo's shots alone caused the deaths of Williams and Russell. Brillo, according to prosecutors, kept shooting at the car when other officers stopped, and prosecutors argued that he jumped on the hood of the car and fired those final 15 shots. Now, officials here and community leaders, again, have been able to keep the streets here peaceful. This is, again, though, a city that is waiting to see whether criminal charges will be pursued in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. Bob?
Sharika Duncan in Cleveland. Thank you so much, Sharika. And we turn now to the campaign against ISIS. The Islamic terrorists have been on the move and have now seized the Iraqi city of Ramadi, just outside Baghdad, and they captured the historic city of Palmyra and other key areas in Syria. CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward is just back from Beirut. She joins us now from London. Clarissa.
Good morning, Bob. Well, ISIS has taken control of another border crossing between Iraq and Syria. Fighters captured the Al-Walid crossing this morning, giving them control of the two main roads between Syria and Anbar province in Iraq, where the group has been pushing forward after taking the city of Ramadi last weekend. Iraqi forces today launched a counteroffensive in Anbar to try to regain some of their losses. Among those forces are thousands of of members of Shiite militias. Of course, the concern there is that the presence of those Shiite militias in Sunni-dominated Anbar will only raise the specter of an all-out sectarian bloodbath. But certainly, the Iraqi government doesn't appear to have a lot of options. Videos from Ramadi last Sunday showed Iraqi security forces fleeing the battlefield, abandoning their bases, leaving behind their American-supplied weapons and equipment. This in spite of intensified U.S. airstrikes against ISIS in the run-up to the fall of Ramadi. And just days later, ISIS took the Syrian city of Palmyra. This is a strategic victory because it's surrounded by gas fields. But it also, Bob, puts the future of some of Syria's most precious cultural heritage in jeopardy. That ancient city's 2,000-year-old ruins are now under the control of ISIS fighters who have previously destroyed cultural relics that they deem to be un-Islamic. So two significant victories in two countries in the course of a week, really calling into question, Bob, the effectiveness of the U.S.'s strategy for dealing with ISIS.
All right. Clarissa Ward in London. Thanks so much, Clarissa. And for more on this, we're now joined by the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, John McCain. Well, you heard what Clarissa just said. You have called this strategy a disaster, but what should we be doing about this, Senator?
I think there's a lot of things we can do. First, have the president recognize that he was incorrect when he said we are not losing. We had before this an Armed Services Committee this week two architects of the surge that won. And we did have it won until the decision was made to withdraw all troops. And I won't get into that fight with you, but Senator Graham and I predicted at the time that this would happen. I'm sorry we were wrong. We need to have a robust strategy. We need more troops on the ground. We need forward air controllers. We're just referring to airstrikes. Do you know that 75% of those combat missions return to base without having fired a weapon? It's because we don't have somebody on the ground who can identify a static, a moving target. And we learned, you know, you're going to be talking about the Vietnam War later on in this. We found in Vietnam that if you don't have the right strategy, air power is minimal in its effect. But we need to have forward air controllers. We need to have special forces. We need to have more of those kind of raids that were so successful into Syria. We need to have a strategy. There is no strategy. And anybody that says that there is, I'd like to hear what it is, because it certainly isn't apparent now. And right now, we are seeing these horrible the reports are now in Palmyra. They're executing people and leaving their bodies in the streets. Meanwhile, the president of the United States is saying that the biggest enemy we have is climate change.
Well, you know, Senator, I mean, and the president called these latest setbacks, he called them technical setbacks or something to that effect. But there's no appetite in this country, I think it's fair to say, for sending a lot more American troops into Iraq. But is that in the end going to be necessary? And I guess the reason I would ask you that, is this posing a threat to our national security?
Well, first of all, there's a larger number of Americans that believe we ought to have more American troops on the ground. Not the massive 82nd Airborne, but certainly in the realm of a number of thousands, so we can do the missions that I just described to you. The beheadings had a profound effect on American public opinion, as it should have. And your second question was...
Well, what can we do?
We can, as I say, forward air controllers, special forces, training, equipping. Right now, it's Shia militia, the same ones that we fought against during the surge, that are now doing the fighting. The overall winner in this whole conflict right now is not ISIS. It's Iran. It's Iran who is controlling four countries now and on the move.
Well, so where does that put us in relation to this this arms deal we're trying to work out to limit nuclear power with Iran? Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Senator?
I think it's a good thing if it's a good deal. But in the words of Henry Kissinger and George Shultz in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, it went from trying to prevent Iran from ever acquiring a nuclear weapon to delaying it. And, of course, when we continue to hear the Ayatollah and others say there'll be no inspection of military facilities, that there were sanctions will be listed immediately. We're hearing two very different stories, and I'm glad at least the Congress of the United States is going to have a role to debate this and to make a judgment on it.
We're hearing in this campaign, which is already well underway, the Democrats are saying this is all George Bush's fault for going to Iraq in the first place. We're hearing the Republicans say, no, wait a minute, this is all Barack Obama's fault for pulling out our troops too soon from Iraq. Whose fault is it? And does that really matter anymore, whose fault it was?
Well, obviously, we don't want to ignore the lessons of history. But given the information that was there at the time given to the American people in Congress, that vote is certainly understandable. And there's a lot of questions about it. Then there should be the question, should we have pulled everybody out? And anybody who says we couldn't have stayed is not telling the truth, because Lindsey Graham, Joe Lieberman, and I were on the ground there and know full well we could have left those, we could have had a residual force or a sustaining force. And do they realize that we had it won? The surge had succeeded. I called for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, my own president's Secretary of Defense, because I saw we were losing. Then George W. Bush at least had the guts to reverse and sponsor the surge, in which we eventually then succeeded. I pray that Barack Obama would do the same thing.
You know, former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was on our broadcast last week.
I saw it.
And he said that... In his words, most of the Republican candidates for president, he said, I'm not very impressed so far. And he said, they really don't have very much experience on foreign policy. What do you think about the current Republican field?
Obviously, Senator Lindsey Graham understands. He's been boots on the ground. He's an Air Force colonel, has served all his time in Baghdad and in Kabul. But I would say this. Ronald Reagan didn't have a lot of foreign policy experience, but he surrounded himself with the smartest guys and people in America. And I think that the next president, whoever he is, can do that as well.
Do you think Hillary Clinton, if she should win the nomination and get and be elected, do you think she'd be a good president? Is she qualified?
I'm not here to judge her qualifications. I will be supporting whoever the Republican nominee is. But I do believe it's a legitimate question to say, what was the concrete accomplishments of her 4 years as Secretary of State? And there are still many unanswered about questions about Benghazi as well. And I think that $750,000 a speech is, in the Hawaiian missionary tradition, doing well by doing good.
All right, Senator McCain, it's always
Thank
a pleasure
you.
To have you.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, California Congressman Adam Schiff. Well, Congressman, you heard John McCain. Give me your analysis for what's going on right now in Iraq and in Syria.
Well, the loss of Rouhani, I think, was a very serious setback, and it's one that is deeply felt, I think, by Americans. We lost a lot of our troops in Rouhani, and this Memorial Day weekend, we think about those losses. They weigh heavily on us. But in terms of the Iraq war itself, I think there's an important lesson here, and that is we won Rouhani, but it didn't stay won, because the political problems that preceded the first Iraq war haven't been solved, and that is the Sunnis have not been brought into the government adequately. Sunni forces haven't been adequately trained and integrated into the military. And until those changes are made, until Iraq makes the political decision to fully incorporate the Sunnis, we can add more forces, we can win these battles, but they're not going to stay won. I think that's the real lesson of the last Iraq war and what's going on now.
Well, you know, years after we came through the Vietnam experience, I remember thinking, you know, we kept asking during that period, are we winning? And when you have to ask the question, generally, you're not winning, because victory is always obvious. Do you think we're winning now?
I would say that we're winning. I don't think we're losing either, but I think we're seeing an ebb and flow and largely a stalemated situation in the war against ISIS. I get concerned when I hear the administration use the metric of how many sorties, how many bombing runs we're doing. I think the more important metrics are, how are we doing in stopping foreign fighters entering the country? How are we doing in drying up ISIS's resources? How are we doing in working with our Gulf allies on fighting the ideological fight within Islam that we're not positioned to fight ourselves? And how are we doing in terms of our military support? And on that latter point, that's where I think Rouhani really comes into play. I think we still have a lot of work to keep the pressure on the Iraqi government to fully incorporate the Sunnis, to peel those Sunni tribes away from ISIS, because until that happens, we're not going to be successful in the military struggle.
Well, what can we do in a realistic standpoint? Is it possible to turn around what seems to be happening right now?
It is possible, and I think we have to intensify efforts first to bring those Sunnis into the government and into the military. I think bringing in Shia militias is the wrong answer. That's going to just aggravate those sectarian tensions. I think sending in our own troops is not the answer either. We can't fight this fight for the Iraqis, but we got to use all the pressure we can to get them to make the political fixes necessary. At the same time, we have made little progress in dealing with the foreign fighter problem. We have to intensify, I think, pressure on Turkey to close down that border to foreign fighters coming in and to oil resources trafficking back and forth across that border. And more broadly, we need more help from our Gulf allies on the ideological struggle against this perversion of Islam.
I'll ask you just what I asked Senator McCain, because I think for Americans it's the most important question, and that is what is happening there really a threat to our security as the nation?
It is a threat to our security, and if ISIS is able to hold that ground unmolested, there's no question that they have the aspiration to attack us here in the United States. In fact, they're already inspiring homegrown radicalism here, as we've seen in attacks like we saw in Garland, Texas. So they are a threat. But again, I think we have to make sure that we don't react the wrong way to that threat. And we could aggravate it by sending a lot of American troops in. And there's a particular risk of escalation if we do.
One other subject. Congress failed to get a deal to extend the National Security Agency surveillance program, which allows for the bulk collection of telephone numbers in this country. Do you see any kind of a compromise on the horizon on this, or is this program just going to shut down on July the 1st, or June 1st, I guess it is? And if it does, what will be the impact of that?
Well, ironically, we had a great compromise. We passed it in the House with over 330 votes, very bipartisan. And there's a majority of support in the Senate itself for that very same compromise. So what happened this week in the Senate, I think, was a catastrophe in terms of rejecting a very well thought out, broadly supported compromise that the intelligence community itself embraces. It has the merit of reforming those authorities to end bulk collection, but maintaining the surveillance tools that are necessary to protect the country. What happens right now, it looks like this program is going to expire. Now, I think the Senate, when it comes back in, I hope will see wisdom and pass what we passed in the House. That's the only way to prevent a real interruption in this program. And, Bob, bear in mind that it's not just the authority for bulk collection that's going to expire. It's some other very important tools as well that deal with roving wiretaps, that deal with lone wolf threats, as well as the more rudimentary use of Section 215 to get records like hotel records or financial records.
All right, we have to stop there, Congressman. Thank you so much for adding to our broadcast this morning.
Face the Nation after this short break.
Listen to everything from full-length news magazine programs like 60 Minutes to bite-sized features like the new Talking Animals show. They're all just a click away. Get CBS Radio News podcasts from iTunes, Stitcher, and AHA.
Back now for some analysis with David Rohde. He writes for Reuters, and Rajiv Chandrasakian, who covered Iraq in the Mideast for the Washington Post. He's now starting his own media company. David, you bring a lot of experience to this whole subject we're talking about. You were actually captured at one point by the Taliban, and thank goodness you're back with us and safe and all that. But I just want to ask both of you, what's happened here? I mean, you know, a week ago we were talking about killing an important ISIS leader, and then, you know, here they are on the march again. It just doesn't seem to be very much good news here.
It shows that this is a very organized, very determined opponent. These are huge propaganda victories for them in jihadist circles. I saw this when I was in captivity. They're going to use this to recruit more and more people to this caliphate, and they have a caliphate. We are not shrinking the size of it. They clearly control the Sunni sort of heartland in Iraq and Syria. And you're asking the right question. Is this a national security threat to the United States? Because it's not going away, and we don't really seem to have any answers to it.
Do you think it's a threat to our security?
I do. I'm biased because of this time in captivity. I was in another safe haven they had in the tribal areas of Pakistan, and they do recruit young men. They brainwash them. They tell them to go be suicide bombers. And I think it's more of a threat to Europe initially, but there will be ISIS-inspired attacks, I think, eventually in the United States.
What do you think, Rajiv? I mean, here's David's talking about they have established a caliphate, which is what they were talking about. Is this something that's going to stay in place?
Well, they certainly have an organized, semi-organized system of government, military command and control, with their expansion now into the areas around Palmyra and Syria, access to more natural resources there that they can smuggle out, which they've used very deftly to fund their operations. They've already seized an awful lot of materiel from Iraqi forces in Mosul and now presumably in the Ramadi area. Look, the threat facing the United States and our European allies is a significant one, and one that will continue for some time to come. According to U.S. intelligence community estimates, there are more than 20,000 foreign fighters that are part of ISIS, drawn from about 100 different countries. Many of these guys are going to go home, and women too, eventually, and some of them could well be behind the attacks of the future in those countries.
The president is saying in interviews he still thinks we're winning against ISIS. What do you all hear from people at a level below the president, national security officials? Are they feeling the same way, David?
They're not. I mean, I think they're discouraged. This idea of the Obama philosophy was to to sit back and force the Iraqis to carry out the fight themselves. Senior officials, the defense secretaries just said that the Iraqis didn't have the heart to fight. They actually fled Ramadi. So I think they're very discouraged in the White House. The strategy is not working. To be fair to the White House, there's no easy answer. The American public doesn't want, 100,000 troops there again. How do you find a local partner, and how do you empower that local partner? And there, to be fair to both sides, there is no easy answer.
What do you see coming? I mean, what do the Iraqis need, Rajiv?
Well, the Iraqis need a will to fight. They also need significant outside pressure to really come together in a more pluralistic way to address the political challenges they have in Baghdad and to get their military to get back into the fight. Some of that, I think, unfortunately, will have to involve some greater U.S. assistance on the ground. I think Senator McCain is right. You can't have effective airstrikes unless you have on-the-ground spotters, and those have to be from the U.S. military or from close allied nations that can direct those airstrikes to prevent civilian casualties. But you have to get the Iraqi government in Baghdad to make some meaningful steps to accommodate that Sunni minority. Right now, they've been completely disenfranchised, and they're acquiescing to ISIS because they see that, sadly, as a better option than the central government in Baghdad. And what it's doing is it's opened the door to Iran to come in, and with the Iranian-backed militias now going through and trying to retake those parts of the country from ISIS, it's simply going to harden positions. And unfortunately, we're heading toward a de facto split of the country.
All right. I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it at that. But thank you both. This Memorial Day comes in a year when we mark the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, when the communists came to power. They still rule there, but we call Vietnam an ally now in a part of the world where we need friends. Vietnam is one of the countries with which the administration hopes to sign a massive trade agreement that will cover 40% of the world's gross domestic product. Vietnam has become a place where Americans are welcomed now, a place where English is spoken as the second language. Much of the credit for that goes to Senator John McCain, who for 5 years was a prisoner of war there. Yet it was McCain who went back to Vietnam to reconcile with those who had brutally tortured him. In so doing, he opened the way to restore diplomatic relations and showed us that sometimes forgiveness can be as powerful a force for change as any weapon we might possess. America learned some hard lessons in Vietnam. That may have been one of them. We'll talk about that with some of the reporters who covered that war when we come back.
Face the Nation after this short break.
Missed your favorite news programs like 60 Minutes or the World News Roundup? Listen to those shows or hear something new like our newest program, Talking Animals. It's all available through our podcasts. Check them out at cbsnews.com/podcasts.
This Memorial Day comes as we mark the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, which ended the Vietnam War, one of the most divisive conflicts in American history. More than 58,000 Americans died in that war. Some 2,000 are still missing. Many reporters also died there. And our friends at the museum here in Washington have just opened an exhibit on the role the press played in reporting the war. It's been dedicated to our late colleague, Bob Simon, who filed many reports from Vietnam. Well, to talk about it and the parallels to today's military conflicts, we've brought together some veteran Vietnam hands. Peter Arnett, who won a Pulitzer for his reporting there for the Associated Press. His new book is Saigon Has Fallen. Photographer David Hume Kennerly also won a Pulitzer for photography while working there for United Press International. Laura Palmer was 22 when she went to Vietnam. She was there for the fall of Saigon. And our own Bill Plant filed many reports for CBS News from there as well. And then there was this young reporter who went there for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in 1965. He seems not to have aged at all. Welcome to all of you. You know, I'm struck by when we think about the length of this war. I went there in 1965. Peter, you were there before I met you in Saigon. And then, David, by the time you got there, it was a totally different war. Peter, tell me about how the war changed as the years went by.
Well, the earlier period when I arrived there in 62, it was the Kennedy administration war. It was an advisor's war, and it was conducted basically secretly. Mm-hmm. We made increasing observations of American military direct involvement with helicopter attacks and aerial bombardments, and we felt it was our job to start reporting on this direct American involvement because there were casualties being taken in the battlefield that was said by the administration to be accidental casualties. But it was a very different conflict in 1965, of course, when American troops began coming in large numbers and you actually arrived with mm-hmm. them.
But as the war went on, in those very early days, most Americans really didn't know very much about what was happening there. By the time you got there, David, the country was very divided over the war, and there were demonstrations back here at home.
Well, that's right. Our responsibility as photographers was to show what was happening to the people, whether it be the soldiers or locals. We have died doing that.
I have heard you say, David, that a picture, and it was actually a picture taken by my Mal Brown, may have been what caused President Kennedy to say, we need to try to do something to stop this.
Well, yes, because it was a burning Buddhist monk, and he was protesting the fact that they were being persecuted by the Catholic government, really. If you look at the trajectory of photographs, through the Pulitzer Prizes or not, Eddie Adams' photo of General Juan shooting the guy in the head, to Nick Hood's photo of the little girl running down the road, the whole arc of the war is really captured in photographs, and they go right to your soul.
Bill, you were there pretty early, too. In fact, you were in and out of Vietnam over a pretty long period of time.
When I first went there, Bob, in 1964, there were American advisors. We knew that they were helping out and sometimes actually fighting, but we basically bought the notion that they were there to help the South Vietnamese. And by the time I came back a second time in 1967, it was pretty apparent that the Americans were doing all the fighting and the South Vietnamese not doing much. And the other thing was that what we were seeing in the field didn't match what the government of the United States was saying, both in Saigon and in Washington. Lyndon Johnson was fighting a limited war, and they had to sell it to the American public as such. But you could just go on any battlefield or out in the country and see that the facts didn't match the story. So we got what they called the credibility gap. Our friend Morley Safer used to wear a badge that said, "I was ambushed." That credibility gap.
And Laura, you were there at the fall of Saigon.
I was there from 72 to 74, and then I returned in April of 75, and I left on the choppers on the last day, April 29th.
What did you feel while that was happening? We've all seen, again, these dramatic photos of that evacuation. It was remarkable that they were able to do what they did, but it was the end of the war.
The final American withdrawal from Vietnam.
It was the end of the war. And I'm part of a generation who was defined by Vietnam. I started college in 1968. I protested the war for the 4 years I was there. I went to Saigon. It's where the rest of my life began. And then there I was on the last day. I was one of the youngest reporters there. And as the chopper lifted up from Saigon, we were holding hands. And we were silent. And there was nothing to say. Sometimes in those moments, silence is the truest speech. And we just watched Vietnam recede into the distance. It was over.
And Peter, you stayed. You did not leave. Tell us what that was like.
You know, I stayed because I'd been sort of there at the beginning. Several of my friends had been killed covering the war. And I had grown to believe, along with my colleagues, that our audiences, the American public, the world, needed sort of the kind of first-hand description of what was going on, as we'd been trying to give throughout the whole war. So I must say that I was intellectually ready for it. But when I saw the trucks, Russian Molotov trucks, rolling down Tudor Street, loaded with these young communist soldiers with their guns and looking up at the tall buildings, I guess not many had seen tall buildings in the jungle, it was sort of, I was overcome with an emotion, and I went back up to our office, and it was not easy to write that dispatch that Saigon has fallen.
I think one of the remarkable things about the evacuation, it struck me at the time, and I still think of it now, is that it was so peaceful. They never turned on us, the South Vietnamese, as we were clearly fleeing and abandoning them. It was a superb military operation. The Marines who came in on those choppers for hours to rescue us were stellar. But we knew, as we were waiting to get to run for the chopper, that the North Vietnamese had surrounded the airport. Any of those choppers could have been shot down with a heat-seeking missile. But the decision had been made not to have a bloodbath, and they were winning. They just wanted us to go.
Do you think, Bill, some said at the time, and I'm not sure, there may still be a feeling by some, that the press somehow lost Vietnam. What was your take on that?
I don't think so. The television is usually what's blamed for bringing the war into America's living rooms, and people could see the horror of it. But the Army's own official history of Vietnam says it wasn't the press, but the casualties that turned the American public against the war. It also says that the press reports were often more accurate than the public statements of U.S. officials. And that President Johnson, this is in the Army's own history, and his advisors put too much faith in public relations. They were trying to fight a war which had so many contradictions that were so evident because there was no censorship, because we could go just about anywhere and see what was happening, that it was simply not winnable in that sense.
David, you were there. You were also involved in later American conflicts and photographed them. How different was the way the press was treated and where we were allowed to go as to what the rules are these days?
Well, if you wanted to go to a battle, and part of the problem was trying to figure out where the action was, but once you found out, they were happy to take you there. You would hop on a helicopter, go into the battle. The thing that I really was remarkable to me was how much the GIs love seeing you show up. That's why we were there. We were there to tell their story of what was going on and not as a political thing. And I agree with Bill. I mean, the press didn't lose the war, but when you started ringing up all the body bags coming back, and several from the high school I graduated from, classmates of mine, class of 65 in high school, how can you win a war in public opinion?
If you were willing to go where the action was, to where these troops were, they were glad to see you. In some cases, they were just lonesome. And I remember my assignment was to, for the Star-Telegram, was to track down kids from Fort Worth and to go and talk to them and do a story about them and send it back home. And I'll always remember a young Marine. I walked up to him, and he was in full battle dress and all of that, and I said, "Your mom asked me to come by and say hello." The kid in full battle gear just broke into sobs. And if you were willing to go where they were, they were glad to see you. Back in Saigon, of course, they weren't also always so happy to see you. What was the hardest thing for you, Bill?
Hardest thing was to see the desperation at the end in the South Vietnamese who had worked for the U.S., who had worked for their own government. I remember in April of 1975, standing outside the U.S. Embassy, there were lines that went around the block of Vietnamese trying desperately to get to the consulate and get a visa to the U.S. to get out of there. Most of them, of course, did not. And they would come up to anyone, a reporter, anyone, and thrust papers and say, "I worked for MACV and I did this. I need visa."
Can you help me too?
And all I could say was, "I'm sorry, I can't help you.
I am sorry, because even I cannot get in there right now."
The sense of abandonment by the U.S. for these people whose lives we basically controlled for so many years was one of the hardest things I've ever witnessed.
David Kennerly, after your work as a war reporter, you wound up being the White House photographer for Gerald Ford, and he actually sent you to Vietnam at one time. What was that about?
Well, right toward the end, President Ford sent General Wine to see if there was anything that could be done to stabilize the situation. I went with him. I took photos, but I brought all these pictures back to the president and showed them to him. The pictures made a profound impact on him. It went right, really, to it just struck him that he had to keep the door open for Vietnamese. And one of the things that I did was I put these photographs of refugees and people dying up in the West Wing of the White House, where normally over the cheery party pictures in color and all that. At some point during the night, the first night they were up, somebody took them down because they were offended. And the president got so angry, he ordered that they be put back up on the wall. He said, "You've got to know what's going on over there." And that's the power of the photograph. And it really struck him. It made a big difference.
Peter, you were involved in the first Iraq War. How, as all of this has evolved, has the relationship between the military and the press been different?
My last reporting period was really most of the 2000s in Iraq, and I was embedded a few times. I signed an 8-page document that restricted basically everything except going to the toilet, and maybe that was in the fine print. But it meant that no photographs of any wounded or harmed American, not getting close to any sort of action. Any interview I would have with anyone in the military would have to be approved and supervised. In each of these embedding periods I had a sense that I wasn't sure what was going on. We have really what I feel are sort of increasingly draconian restraints on the press, and I think that's not good for the public.
Are you all struck by the parallels between Vietnam and what's going on now in Iraq? And I say this, you know, we went to Vietnam not to conquer territory, but to try to protect the South Vietnamese from a communist takeover. We went to Iraq not to conquer, but to kind of protect. And then we wind up fighting the war instead of helping those who were there fight the war. And then once we begin to draw down, we leave, we turn over the equipment, and the whole thing collapses.
Well, it seems to me, Bob, that in both cases we've misjudged the enemy. We misjudged the North Vietnamese. We were worried at the time about the dominoes falling in Southeast Asia, all those countries becoming communist. That might indeed have happened, but South Vietnam and North Vietnam were one country that had been fighting the Chinese for 1,000 years, and yet we thought the Chinese were going to take them over. We didn't understand. And I'm not sure we understand exactly what's going on today in the Middle East.
I think this is the most dangerous possible place to cover. I think it's more dangerous than Vietnam, because at least in Vietnam you had kind of a safe place to go back to for all intents and purposes in Saigon. But being an American or a European correspondent in that area, you might as well put a big sign on it that says, kidnap me or kill me. And it's really tough. There's no independent reporting coming out of there at all. I mean, they're picking up all sorts of ISIS propaganda and whatnot, but that's not how you want to get your facts.
People say, weren't you afraid in Vietnam? It was a war. And actually, we were very safe in Vietnam. We knew which highways were dangerous. We knew where not to go. There were no suicide bombers. We are in such a much more dangerous world in terms of reporting. I mean, those who have reported from Syria have taken such enormous risks to tell the story. And I think that's a tremendous shift.
Oh, indeed, it is a dangerous area. But we must realize that how do you measure the risk you take as a reporter for your news organization as against public interest in what you're covering. I mean, I had no doubt in Vietnam that when me and my colleagues, photographers, reporters, went out in the field, there was a real audience wanting to know what we were reporting.
Nobody was interested in what you were writing about in 1962 or 63. I mean, that was a war that most Americans weren't focused on at all. So where do you...
Well, it was not interested because the Kennedy administration said, don't worry, everything's under control. It became interesting when we discovered that the claims of the government were erroneous and fraudulent, in fact. And that's where public and political interest grew in Vietnam, that somehow the government was obscuring the truth.
The American people became interested when the body bags started coming back. That's when we began. And there was also a draft. Let me ask you this, Bill. Do you think, I think Vietnam changed America. Before then, we were the victors in World War II. We thought there was no foe that we could not conquer. We were in the midst of the Cold War, and then after Vietnam, we began to question a lot of things, not the least of which, I mean, there was this divide between the military and the civilian population. You didn't have that before, even with the draft. Everybody felt like they had a stake in this. It seems to me since then, and I think it's a very sad thing, you know, you have the military community here and you have the civilian community here. And I know people now some of whom that probably don't know a single person in the U.S. military.
Well,
right,
Vietnam,
now. And I think that's a very bad thing.
Vietnam ended the Pax Americana, which followed the Second World War. That was one huge upheaval. The other was, as you say, the separation of the military and the civilian population. The pressures of the Vietnam War ended the draft. There are many people today who believe that some kind of obligatory government service would be very good for young people, but we're not likely to see it. And it did set two separate classes of people apart, those who serve and those who don't.
Just one point to remember, in the past, connecting those who served with the people at home were the media. It was the Ernie Pyles and the reporters back into the late 19th century who made the connection. In Vietnam, we're talking earlier about going out and writing hometown stories. One of the great pleasures was to talk and talk, you go back to the unit and say, I got the clipping from my mom and my picture looks great. We were the connecting point. With the restrictions that the military and government imposes on journalists today, you don't have reporters telling those stories anymore. This is a problem, and I hope the government ultimately realize that we have a role to play when our own people are committed to these foreign conflicts.
Laura, we really don't end wars, though, do we?
No, one of the things that Vietnam taught me and the reporting I did subsequently after the war was that wars don't end. They come home, and it's the women and the children who fight them. There is a war to find beauty and meaning in life again. There is sometimes a war to learn how to pick up a fork, how to tie a shoe, how to reconnect with a world that sent you to do something you never really thought you were going to do. And the aftermath of war is something that is profound. And I think while we didn't recognize the soldiers enough after Vietnam, I think one of the outrages was we blamed the war on the people who fought it, and we, in time, learned to separate the warriors from the war. Now sometimes you come home from war and you get a Super Bowl ticket or you get parades, but you still should not have to wait 10 months to get mental health support at a VA. And I think there is a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done to help people make it home from the war.
Well, some thoughts for all of us on this Memorial Day weekend. Thanks to all of you. Well, our time's up for today. I hope you can join me next week for my last broadcast as host of Face the Nation. Hope to see you then. Today's guests were Senator John McCain and Congressman Adam Schiff. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hinden and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne. Face the Nation originates in CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.